KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, Julian Schnabel, the painter and director, on his controversial new movie, Morale. He may be the only independent film director in the universe who says he doesn't have to worry about financing. Plus, we interrogate Simon Cowell on leaving American Idol and launching his new show, The X Factor. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by John Horn of the Los Angeles Times by phone. John, as we record this, has been taking a break from the slopes, right, John?
Just a little bit. I would say from the blizzards, yes.
Sounds fun. So our friends at Sony are trying an interesting experiment. They are going to offer you a bargain, John, on two of their recent releases.
This is a little bit like shopping at Big Lots, where it's not quite the quality of merchandise you'll find at Target, but it's the next stop down. They have decided to sell The Tourist and How Do You Know for download on Amazon.com and iTunes for $13, which is $2 cheaper than it would cost to buy the DVD itself.
Now, the idea here is supposedly that Sony is fishing for a way to sell more downloads and not cut into DVD sales. As we know, DVD sales have already been drastically cut into. So I think that really it'd be more accurate maybe to say to sell more downloads to make up for the swooning DVD sales.
And obviously for the last 20 years, DVDs have been the lifeblood of Hollywood. And people are no longer building the libraries. They're not going out and buying Blu-ray discs. So I think it's an interesting tactic, but I think it raises the more provocative question as whether or not there is tiered pricing, meaning you pay full retail for a good movie and less than retail for movies like The Tourist and How Do You Know, which were both domestically critical and commercial bombs. How Do You Know? An international bomb as
yeah,
well, but The Tourist,
I mean, a big
did some
bomb,
business
yeah.
overseas.
The Tourist did well overseas. How Do You Know? You know, $120 million give or take, and just very little business domestically or worldwide. A big miss for Sony. James L. Brooks film with Reese Witherspoon and a lot of stars, and just nothing. So now you can get a deal if you want to see it. I guess it's a deal. $13. What do you think?
I think maybe $5. You might start moving some discs. It could be like a used car lot. No reasonable offer refused.
A cruel fate. Meanwhile, a subject that is close to you, John, because you've been writing about this a lot, China, the Chinese market, which, as we know, is very restrictive with American films, but a big honking market getting bigger all the time, and with the Chinese middle class hungering for movies. And IMAX is going to open 75 new theaters there, and this is part of a pretty dramatic expansion.
Over the last 4 years, the number of screens in China has doubled to about 6,200, and still it's well behind the ratio of screens to population that the United States has. So IMAX is betting, and I think it's probably a smart bet, that the Chinese economy is going to continue to grow, the Chinese middle class is going to continue to grow, and their interest in movies is going to continue to grow. Now, the real issue is how many non-Chinese films will come into China. It's still an incredibly restrictive market. So IMAX, I think, is betting that market's going to improve, and they're going to build these screens in the hopes that there'll be a lot more non-Chinese films exhibited in the world's largest nation.
And it's worth noting that IMAX has a really good track record of getting the movies that it wants to play the American movies on Chinese screens in China. This Richard Gelfond, who is their chief executive, apparently has spent years courting the Chinese. He's done things like developing a portable theater to play in rural areas, and he's making a lot of headway, and a lot of studios, I'm sure, would love to figure out, you know, what the secret sauce is there.
Well, and maybe IMAX can do business with Mars Needs Moms in China, because they sure didn't do any IMAX business with a film in the United States.
Meanwhile, here in the States this week, CinemaCon will happen. It used to be called Show West. I think, John, you're headed that way, and there's going to be a lot of product unveiled for theater owners.
This is an annual convention in Las Vegas. It's kind of fallen out of favor lately as movie theater chains have consolidated, but it still is a good showcase for upcoming films and for low-fat popcorn oil. And I think what you're going to see this year is maybe a slightly bigger presence from some of the studios. Paramount's going to take some footage from J.J. Abrams' Super 8. Sony may be showing 30 minutes or less, a movie they think is a sleeper summer title. So in some ways, it's a great place for the studios to raise their profile of movies that they think need a little extra bump.
Now, the movie that really wouldn't appear to need a little extra bump is The King's Speech. Our friends at the Weinstein Company had promised or threatened a PG-13 version, and now we've all been waiting to figure out whether they're actually going to do this after it won Best Picture. They are.
And it sounds like it's going to have a lot fewer F-bombs. Is that the plan?
That's the plan. It comes out, of all dates, John, April 1st.
In some ways, it's a fitting date because the original R rating that was given to the film by the Motion Picture Association is a joke itself.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Julian Schnabel has been a force in the art world for 30 years. His paintings can go for upwards of $1 million. But in the mid-90s, he ventured into film, writing and directing Basquiat. Jeffrey Wright played Jean-Michel Basquiat, the one-time street artist who had a mercurial rise, but who lived fast and died young. That movie did well enough in limited release to establish Schnabel as a filmmaker. He followed up in 2000 with Before Night Falls, which earned Javier Bardem an Oscar nomination for his role as Cuban poet Reynaldo Arenas. Then in 2007, Schnabel released his most lauded film yet, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. Made in French, the movie was based on the autobiography of Jean-Dominique Bauby, a fashion magazine editor who suffered a massive, paralyzing stroke. The film tells how Bauby learned to communicate by blinking his left eye, which enabled him to dictate a book to his nurse. The movie won numerous awards, and Schnabel was nominated for an Oscar for Best Director. When The Diving Bell and the Butterfly showed at the Venice Film Festival in 2007, Schnabel met the inspiration for his latest film. Palestinian journalist Rula Jibrial wrote the autobiographical novel Miral, which dealt with the Palestinian struggle for statehood as seen through the lives of three women. It became the basis for Schnabel's latest film.
I have to deal with the Israelis every day. You have to think. Prudence is the most precious virtue.
You don't understand anything! If you were me, you would be out there too. This is our struggle!
Listen, girl! This school is the difference between you and the children in the refugee camp.
Jibrial and Schnabel began to work on a script, and they became a couple. Miral, which was shot in Israel and Palestine, had its European premiere at the Venice Film Festival last year. It was subsequently picked up for distribution in the U.S. by the Weinstein Company, and it had its American premiere earlier this month when it screened before the U.N. General Assembly. That prompted protests from the State of Israel and some Jewish groups who see the film as anti-Israel. The French financier and distribution company, Pathé, which funded The Diving Bell and The Butterfly, also backed Miral. Given that the film was bound to be controversial, not to mention its unconventional narrative structure, I asked Schnabel whether it was a challenge to get financing for it.
I think when people want to get in business with me, since you're talking about business, they don't expect to have the typical fare.
Right.
They want to get the blue plate special. So, I mean, in every case, for every movie that I made, I did it in an unconventional way. It's different each time. When I made Basquiat, it cost $3.6 million, and I put in $1.2 million myself, and two of my friends put in the other two-thirds, and I guaranteed their money with paintings of mine, and it did okay, so I didn't have to give any paintings up. And
wow, you guaranteed it with your paintings.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that before. Very few people could do that.
Yeah, and then when I made Before Night Falls, I borrowed $9 million from a friend of mine, and I guaranteed that and repaid the money. And so I financed the movie myself. And then when I made The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, Jerome Sedoux from Pathé financed that movie. And even though I insisted on making the movie in French, and they knew they would their revenues would
be
limited in some way, I said, you know, this is the way we have to do it. If you want to do it, great. If not, it's okay. Just say no. So he shook hands with me, and that was it. And he was very proud of that film, and we had a great relationship. And I was reading this book. I said, this is the movie that I'd like to make.
Murrell.
Yes, Murrell. He loved, and Sophie, his wife, they loved the story. And that was it. And on all of my films, I've worked with John Killick, who's my producer, my friend, and he knows how to spend the money. So at the end of the day, the film gets developed and we get to see it on the screen.
I think you're the first artist guest we've had on The Business. So, and I'm sort of fascinated. When you guarantee the financing with a painting, do you pick one out and say, this is the one, this is the painting?
Did I do that? No. In the case of Basquiat, we knew how much money each of these guys spent, and I'd have to give something that was the market price of those pictures. So we never got to the point where I didn't have to put the paintings in escrow or something and keep them in a safe until we saw if they got the money back. Anyway, all of these people collect paintings of mine.
So it all works out.
And the fact is that because I'm a painter and I don't really expect to make money being a movie, I mean, it's not a job to me.
Right.
I do it because I feel a moral responsibility, or I just want to make the movie as a making a work of art. And my goal is to be as true to my vision of the thing as possible, not to lowbrow it to the lowest common denominator and not care about the product that I make.
So the movie premiered in Venice last year, but here in the U.S. it was at the U.N.
Yes.
Why was that?
Because it's a powerful, resonant, historical room where lots of decisions have taken place, where the birth of Israel took place, where John F. Kennedy and Fidel Castro and Che Guevara and Nikita Khrushchev, and that we have the collective memory of events that happened there, that it's a platform for peace where people are supposed to be heard and there's supposed to be a dialogue. So I thought that that was a good room to show this movie in, because the movie is a cry for peace and understanding and empathy. And it was an instinctive, intuitive decision that I made, and it's something that I thought would be powerful.
Did it feel like you thought it would feel or hoped it would feel?
Better.
Well, Israel, as well as a Jewish group, at least one, maybe more, protested the screening at the UN.
Mm-hmm.
And you shot in Israel.
Yes, and in Palestine.
And as we know, you're a Jew yourself.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear the government of Israel is objecting to this movie, showing the movie at the UN.
Silly.
It seems silly. Yeah.
I didn't do something that, first of all, was anti-Israeli or negative in any way. I think that I was extremely, I was accurate to Rula's book.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with painter and filmmaker Julian Schnabel. His new film, Murrell, tells the story of three generations of Palestinian women. It premiered in the U.S. earlier this month at the U.N. General Assembly, prompting protests from the State of Israel and some Jewish groups. I asked Schnabel if he expected the backlash.
Why do you think I made the movie?
Well, I think you probably made the movie because the story spoke to you and because you felt, as you said, that it was a cry for people to stop thinking in a particular preset way and maybe consider each other as people. Is that fair?
Yeah. Yes, it is. And I don't really see making movies as a business. For me, it's a way of communicating. I know that some would say, okay, there's certain filmmakers that have made $1 billion or hundreds of millions of dollars, and those are the most successful ones. But me personally, I don't really gauge success in that way. I think that the goal is to think of film in terms of a language that you are either adding to or you're not adding to. And in the context of that, that's really my goal. for example, you told me that you liked The Diving Bell and The Butterfly.
Yes.
Well, somebody could look at it and go, well, why should we make a movie about a paralyzed guy? Nobody's going to want to see that.
I'm sure people did say that.
And on the other hand, why would I want to make a movie about a guy that can't move in a moving picture?
Right.
Because it sets up a new set of variables, because your character can't move. So you have to think of, all right, if he can't move, I can cut somebody's head off. And they think, oh, it's not that the director doesn't know where to put the camera. It's that the guy can't move his neck. People walk in and out of the frame. All of a sudden, you get a whole new set of possibilities of what you can shoot. So it's, for me, it's very tedious sometimes. I watch most movies. There's the over-the-shoulder shot, the two-shot, the wide shot. And there's a language that is very rote. And it doesn't matter what story is being told. It's just uninteresting to watch.
Do you get yourself engaged with things like, what is the marketing going to be like, and what is the one sheet going to look like, and all of this mundane stuff that a lot of people who are thinking themselves as building a career in film obsess about?
That's not mundane, actually. After you make the thing, you have to mediate it into the world. I'm sitting here talking to you because
yes.
I'm trying to create an awareness around the film so people go to the movies and see it, because I want them to hear this message.
Right.
So the one sheet, and I've actually made all of the posters for all of my movies, it has to do, it memorializes that thing, and it's made not necessarily to be the most accessible thing in the world, but to make it as beautiful as it can be and as powerful as it can be. And did you see the LA Times this Sunday?
Probably.
But did you see an ad for Miral in it? It didn't look like all the other ads in the newspaper. There was a full page. It was black and red, and it was very graphic. And how do you remember something? How do you memorialize something? And what will get somebody to go see the movie? So the one sheet, you can't minimize that. And the marketing plan, it's another cap that you have to put on your head.
Right.
And John and I and Rula spent a lot of time thinking about when this movie would come out, how Harvey would distribute this movie, and like you said to me, how did I feel about the movie being screened at the United Nations? That was a very deliberate thing that I did, and it was not something that happens easily. To put a screen in there and do all of that and get Boston Light and Sound to do something, it cost a couple $100,000. It's more than doing it at the Ziegfeld Theater. But what did I get out of that? I thought it was great to see all those people in that room looking at that film. What does an artist get, a painter, out of having a show in a gallery? I mean, you could sell the paintings without putting them in the gallery. What you do is you put the paintings there so you could see them the way that you wanted other people to see them, or the way you wanted to see them realized.
So having shown the film at the UN, and you've generated controversy, and now the controversy is part of the ad campaign, the movie they didn't want you to see. Well, I don't know. I guess they didn't want them to see at the UN. I don't know if is there more they that doesn't want people?
Well, I don't think there's a they. I think what is better said, it's the movie we've been waiting for about our time. My interpretation of it would be that, rather than, I don't know what they you're looking for, but it's not the they that I'm
looking
for. I don't
know. I didn't write the ad.
Exactly. Yeah. Me neither.
Okay. Julian Schnabel is an artist and filmmaker. His latest film, Miral, based on the autobiographical novel by Palestinian journalist Rula Jebriel, opened March 25th. Thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
To see Schnabel's ad for Miral, go to our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can comment about the show. Coming up after a short break, everyone's favorite reality TV meanie, Simon Cowell. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and kcrw.com. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. When Simon Cowell left as curmudgeon and truth-teller on American Idol last year, many expected trouble for the show dubbed the Death Star by its competitors in the TV business. But Idol, now in its 10th season, has held up pretty well. It's seen some ratings declines, but it still crushes the competition. Meanwhile, Cowell, who was said to be at odds with Idol creator Simon Fuller, is working on the U.S. version of another talent show, The X Factor, which premieres in the fall on Fox. Cowell created and owns the show, which has been a big hit in Britain and has been replicated in countries around the world. It's already been announced that music industry mogul L.A. Reid will be one of the judges for the American edition, and Cowell says Paula Abdul is also a definite maybe. Auditions for the show are underway now. This past weekend, hopefuls turned out in Los Angeles, and in the next 2 months, they'll be in Miami, Newark, Dallas, and Chicago. I asked Cowell to describe the launch of X Factor compared with the launch of Idol.
I was doing exactly the same thing. I was talking to people, talking up a show, which nobody knew anything about. This is when we were trying to get people to audition in the first place, and praying that it was going to work and that people would like it. But until people actually showed up, we didn't know whether the show was going to work or not. And it's the same principle now, is that no matter what your ambitions are for one of these shows, it absolutely depends on who the contestants are. If they're all useless and boring, you haven't got a show.
I mean, is it overstating it to say you would be worried about talent not knowing what X Factor is and not turning out the way they do for Idol now?
I said from the beginning I was going to put my money where my mouth is. So we put up, in addition to a recording contract, $5 million to the winner of this show as a statement to say that I actually did believe that we could find somebody who could become a world star.
Because, I mean, is that $5 million cash on the barrel head?
It's $5 million cash, guaranteed. Whether you sell one record or 10 million records, you get $5 million.
I'm tuning up right now. I'm starting to, do some...
Well, it's worth it, right?
Work on my vocals.
Definitely,
yeah.
Worth a shot. And look, to be honest with you, I've done these shows enough now, whether it's Leona Lewis or, in contrast, Susan Boyle, that if you make the search wide enough and you're open-minded enough, you've got a great chance of finding a true star. And somebody hopefully is listening to this call now going, I'm going to give this a shot.
Do you have a number in your head? What sort of rating would be a win for you?
I mean, anything over 20 million would be good first week, right?
I think it would be great.
But there's never any guarantee. I mean, it would be insane to tell you now this show is going to do better than anybody else, because I haven't started filming it yet. And I've sat there many, many times during auditions thinking, this is going to be a complete and utter disaster. And then somebody good walks in an hour later.
Right. Now, an Idol, you know, it was notorious for bad blood toward the end and ill feeling. You know, so much success and yet tension. Is that just a part of something when it's that big and that successful that there's going to be some kind of bad blood?
Well, there wasn't bad blood from my point of view. I mean, I was very grateful for the show because otherwise I wouldn't be talking to you today. I mean, it did a lot of good for a lot of people and we've all benefited from it. It's sad when you read about the producers saying that I'm glad Simon's not on the show anymore, that it's better without him, because you kind of wish that they would say that to your face rather than in public, because I kind of didn't feel that when I was on the show. I thought we all liked each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm happy now that I'm launching something new with people who do want to work with me, and the network are enthusiastic and I'm enthusiastic, and I want to change somebody's life at the end of this process.
So the notion that you would be happy if Idol failed without you, is that just fanciful?
No, I never said that. I mean, look, I still talk to Randy, Ryan, two of the producers. I talk every day to on other projects. There's a couple of people maybe who have a grudge. But no, we always said that if that show remains popular, it means that people are still interested in these type of shows. But we are competitive with each other, which is healthy. And, you know, each show wants to do better than the other. But it's not just Idol. I mean, it's Dancing with the Stars. You know, we're all competitive with each other, but that's a good thing.
Now, when Idol gave up Pop Idol in Britain to keep you as a judge here in the U.S., and that gave a clear shot for X Factor. I'm curious if you can tell us anything what that negotiation was like. There are a lot of, you know, cooks in that kitchen between Fox and the various owners of Idol.
Well, I think Fox at one point may have thought that when I launched X Factor that we were then going to take it on to a competing network. And that was never the case. You know, we did have offers from other networks to put the show on.
I should think so.
Yeah, well, they were, and one was very aggressive about trying to persuade us to put it up against Idol.
Does it start with N? NBC? Just a guess, you know?
You never know. But you know, Fox had given me my break, and they'd been very good to me over the years, so we were never going to do that. And in the end, we came to, I think, a very amicable agreement that last year was going to be my last year on Idol. And there was definitely a gap in the market for September to December for something new, because there aren't really any shows like this on at that time of the year.
Right. We've already teased out a couple of judges, and I know you've worked the leaking to the press thing in the UK for the show.
Kim, I haven't worked it. We cannot keep anything secret.
I mean, we already know L.A. Reid will be a judge. We've heard about the Mariah Carey pregnancy and why she won't be a judge.
Yep.
And so are we going to have that sort of thing leaking out up until September?
Well, if it carries on the way it is, yes, everything we're trying to keep secret will be leaked within seconds. And you're going to know exactly who we're talking to and who we're considering and who we're not. And the truth is, the reason we haven't announced the panel yet is that nobody can agree, and new people keep coming along every week who we want to see. And that's why we haven't confirmed the judging panel yet. All the hosts.
And the formation of the judging panel, especially watching what happened with Idol after you left, has got to be one of the most fascinating processes to be inside of, you know? I'd really be curious about how you weigh these various elements that you want in the chemistry.
Well, what you do is you make a decision, then you get nervous about it, then you wake up in the middle of the night saying, I've made a terrible mistake. You call everybody the following day to say you've changed your mind, and then 24 hours later, you go through the same process again. And then when you think everyone's agreed, you get a phone call from a producer at 3 a.m. saying, I've got to speak to you. I'm really nervous about this decision. I think we're doing the wrong thing. And I say, oh, God, here we go again. But this happens on all of our shows. And I've been on shows before where the day before we're due to film, we haven't decided who's going to be on the show.
I mean, it's a huge commitment.
That has happened. Massive.
Is it like a rabbi, a minister, and a priest? You say we need one from column A and two from column B?
Well, I always put it down in basic forms, is that you've got to kind of imagine that you're having a dinner party, and it's a very, very long dinner party, and who you could bear to spend that much time with. Because it really comes down to that. If you haven't got a chemistry, or if you can't work together, it is total, utter misery.
I have to say, I do miss you as a judge on Idol. Nobody is saying the words that you used to say, which is, that was a huge mistake, and you're probably going to be gone. Do you watch?
I watched it when I was over a couple of weeks ago. And it was interesting. I was watching it with some friends. And for a moment, it's like you're on the show and somebody's singing and you want to say something, and then suddenly you realize you're not on the show and you're listening to somebody else going, what are you listening to there? It's a really odd experience. But they genuinely seem to be happy, and the audience seem to like it. So I guess everyone's happy.
Simon Cowell is executive producer and judge on the new Fox talent show, The X Factor. We spoke with him by phone from London. Thank you so much.
Kim, it's been an absolute pleasure.
And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. To leave a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness, where you can also stream and podcast the show and check out past episodes. You can also hear us on your phone with our KCRW iPhone and Android apps. And of course, you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. And check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/KCRW The Business. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.